Welcome back to the Pod of Greed.
Welcome back indeed. I'm Paul.
And I'm Alec.
And we are here, the only Yu-Gi-Oh! Podcast on the internet.
There literally are none. There's none. I searched Yu-Gi-Oh! APS Alec Paul Podcast.
And we're nothing the else
only
came
thing
up,
that
yeah.
comes up.
It's yeah, the I don't only know how thing. That, how that works.
So, yeah. You know,
crazy.
All your Yu-Gi-Oh! News, all your gaming news right here. Don't go to IGN or any of that. We're the only news.
Correct. And today, we've got Yu-Gi-Oh!, Pokemon, and actually a new kind of fun surprise I have in mind. I haven't told Alec what it is yet, though. So
guys, I'm scared.
You guys will like it. Sort of like segment sort of thing. And if people enjoy it, we can maybe do it more. But anywho, before we get into all of that, I'd like to remind you guys, of course, to leave a one in the
chat
if you are watching the YouTube premiere. And if you're not and you're just watching this later, then thumbs up the video. In fact, you can thumbs up the video either way. Like, I don't know why
I'm distinguishing these two things. I mean, anyone can do it, but we really appreciate our premiere gang getting it done.
Yeah, or if you're like listening, you can leave a positive review.
And there's another group of people I want to shout out too.
Oh, okay.
Our channel members.
Oh, yeah, can't forget about them. If you're a channel member, we certainly appreciate that. As always, there's bonus episodes. But enough shilling. We have work to get to. There's so much to talk about, Alec, because we missed last week. So
I mean, we were here. We just didn't like cover like news.
Yeah, we were answering Pot of Greed questions,
which was fun.
Yeah, that was fun actually. A lot of thoughts and comments shared on that last podcast.
So. Oh yeah, for sure.
Okay,
go back and check it out if you didn't see it.
Yeah, it's a good one. So there's not actually a load of Yu-Gi-Oh! News, but I did want to say that, you know, Quarter Century Bonanza finally released last week.
Yep.
We were able to get our hands on it. What did you think after having kind of gotten the set in your hands and opening it?
It's finally the first set that's almost as good as Rarity Collection.
Mm-hmm.
Rarity Collection 1, we don't talk about that.
Rarity Collection 2, yeah, Redheaded Stepchild. Yeah, I mean, I had a pretty good time. I opened a box. I didn't really get a great box, but you were opening some.
Yeah,
and locals.
So for anyone, if you're like me, that you didn't really go hard in the last like year of Yu-Gi-Oh, where like new staples were coming out and they were secret rare and expensive, and yeah, you know, you just kind of didn't pull them, so you didn't bother buying them. This was actually a really fun set to finally start correcting some of the damage I'd done.
Yeah.
I mean, I pulled like multiple SP Little Knights. I finally got my hands on a couple copies of Triple Tactics Thrust. That was fun. I forgot Thrust was even in there, and I don't even have any. Or else I didn't have any.
Yeah, I grabbed like Bonfires and things. Yeah,
Bonfires were in there. The Abel Star was in there.
I was pleased with some of the rarity upgrades. I got like Neptibis and Atlantean Dragoons.
If I can be selfish, I just want to shout out all of the Ancient Gear rarity upgrades that were in this set.
Yeah, they got a lot of
I don't know who did it, who made it happen, but that was for me.
Yeah, they got a few cards in there.
We got upgrades for like Ancient Gear Howitzer, who originally was just a common. We got an important reprint and a rarity bump for Ancient Gear Fortress, which was only available in a structure deck that you just kind of can't find anymore.
Yeah, a lot of cards like that. It's a funny thing in Yu-Gi-Oh! Sometimes like cards can be common, but if they're like only in a structure, it's still sometimes a little hard to find them after they're
Or they might be in one set, like Clockwork Knight. I mean,
yeah,
Clockwork Knight isn't a crazy card, but it's very useful in that deck. And now we're getting a Link monster also named Clockwork Knight that searches it. So
it makes sense they would reprint it.
We really needed that.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Quarter Century Bonanza was overall pretty good.
Solid set.
Yeah, solid set. If you have been opening it, you know, have you enjoyed it? What have your pulls been like? Do you feel like it's worth the money? I think it's been good.
The only thing I haven't gotten from a set that I still really, really want is the Ultimate Rare Thunder Dragon Colossus? Because, you know, the ultimate rares in this set, they have that textured foiling to them.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And we actually pulled one when we were opening up the Japanese set. What was
That's
it called?
That's true.
Actually, that was the Japanese rarity collection, I think.
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, we pulled a Colossus there, and I kept it because I was like, oh, we're never going to get this rarity. And then here we are. And Colossus is now in English in the rarity I want, so I got to go get it.
So, other than that, there actually hasn't been, like, a load of TCG news, per se. Like, some OCG cards got revealed for the next set, but I wasn't really going to go over those, because, like, we're not usually covering a lot of that stuff until it comes out. But there was something kind of cool. According to the Yu-Gi-Oh! Card database, like the official kind of site, here are the top 10 most popular decks in the TCG. And this was posted by Yu-Gi-Oh! News TCG. So I'm actually not even aware how you go in and check this.
Yeah, I don't know how they decide the answer to this question.
Yeah, but I guess it's like maybe based on decks submitted for tournaments. Like, since you have to use Neuron to sign up for tournaments, maybe like they kind of label them that way.
Okay, all right.
I'm not really sure. But
so whose favorite deck didn't make the list?
So at number 10, we got Labyrinth.
That makes
a lot of sense.
That's such a consistent tournament contender.
Yeah, it feels like it really goes to show how that deck has aged quite well and like stayed thematically popular for people, because, you know, people love like Lovely Lady of the Labyrinth or whatever.
Yeah, you have the waifu factor, but you have an engine that is consistent and that works with a type of card that just gets better over time.
Exactly. Number 9 actually is Millennium, which I'm a little bit skeptical.
Okay.
About this.
I could believe it just because Millennium is a cheap deck or a cheap core to get together. So even though it's not winning a load of events and topping like crazy, I could see a lot of people at least entering with it.
Yeah. Now, my guess too is that I know like some of the Millennium cards have become more popular as techs in like other engines and like as engines for other decks. So I don't know if that's maybe skewing some of the data here, but cool. Number 8 is Branded. Or as they list it, Branded plus Despia plus Fallen of Albaz, because, you know, it's all kind of
Branded.
Branded.
Branded should be there. It's just, that's going to be a deck that just sticks around forever.
Super duper timeless, I feel. Like, it's just the new age, maybe Invoked, kind of Shadal.
Yeah, vibes. Invoked Shadal. That actually is a vibe here.
I gotta say, I mean, they outdid themselves with I think the overall Branded story and like the design of that deck, Sword Soul, like all of them, they just feel like a good, strong power level, kind of easy to get into, but like a lot of depth to them, a lot of ways to build the decks. Like, just that whole story, like, even I guess, like, you know, Sprite kind of is in there as well, and like Dogmatic and all that stuff. Like, it, good job, like, on that, I'd say. Number 7 is White Forest.
Oh, that's cool.
That's kind of picked up.
Yeah, I mean, it is it's a very interesting deck. And that has a lot of potential for the future.
Yeah, I've seen it combined so far with, like, I saw Runic White Forest is fairly popular, but also some people
Runic
do it.
Runic White Forest.
Azamina, I think, is going to become
Azamina, more. Azamina, Centurion.
Yeah. Number 6 is Voiceless Voice. That's a personal favorite of mine. Kind of surprised to see this. I mean, I felt like Voiceless Voice had sort of fallen off in the tournament scene, but...
I mean, but we're not talking about winning. This is just entering, right?
Yeah.
A lot of people made the mistake of entering with it, it seems.
Yeah, Voiceless Voice. I really think Konami intended it to be a stronger meta thing than it ended up being. Like, I play the deck. I'll be sharing some experiences I've had with it this past weekend here in a bit. But I think it's pretty good, but I think it's pretty fair. I think that's kind of always been what holds it back from, like, taking the tippy top of competition.
If we could talk to like a Yu-Gi-Oh card dev, I imagine they would say something on the lines of, yeah, we actually thought this deck was going to be like tier one. And
I mean, you can tell because they did like the ultimate rare Diviner of the Herald. Mm-hmm. And then they did like ultimate rare low in this last OTS pack. And like, it's like not worth anything because everyone's like, voice this kind of sucks. Like, why would I want this?
I don't think Konami expected us to be just pile decking.
Yeah, like, and then to be clear, I mean, I do want ulti lows if anyone's offering, but
no, get your room.
Number 5, Centurion Bestial. So
I guess Bestials are the way to run like a pure Centurion deck.
Yeah, they work really well with them. The Centurions are all lights. The Bestial's level works well with like the Centurion's level.
Oh.
That one Branded Regained. There's just a lot of good natural synergy. They can search for, like, Bestial Magnemite can search for one of the Centurion, like, dragon cards. Like, it's a nice synergy.
Nice coincidental synergy. All right.
Yeah, Centurion, also just a really good deck in general. Number 4, Fiendsmith Ubel.
Now, that's a strong deck.
Yeah, that's a strong one. That one, I mean, I think right now most people kind of consider it to be, up until right when Azamina came out, it was like, just the best deck. Like, it still is like top 2 or so, but like, yeah, I remember because the ban list didn't hit it super duper hard at all. It was like real slaps in the wrist, and
you know, I finally built it.
Oh, like your
I have a U-Bell Fiendsmith deck. At least until I can figure out a way to build pure Fiendsmith, though I have not figured that out yet.
Number three is Fiendsmith Snake Eye.
That just makes sense.
Kind of makes sense. Number two is Snake Eye Fire King.
All right.
Which is neat because, I mean, it's like it's cool to know that Snake Eye Fire King kind of came back into popularity with the release of like Ulcanix.
Right.
And since like Snake Eye got hit, it seems like they're leaning more on the fire side of it.
And I mean, it is a cheaper version of the deck to build than like Fiendsmith Snake Eye. So it makes a lot of people would bring that versus Fiendsmith if money is like an issue.
That's true. It's a little cheaper. And then number one actually is Tenpai Dragon.
Which I guess will be the cheapest of all.
Yeah, it's not. It shouldn't be, I guess, a huge surprise, especially now that like even just getting Trident Dragon is like easy. It's, you know,
I forget. Where was he reprinted?
The tens. No, I mean, his price might still be like a little high because like the tens are kind of hard to pull. So, but yeah, they reprinted.
Look it up. I'm curious what he's going for because I forgot that he got a reprint.
And like the thing is, the deck doesn't even actually have to run Trident Dragon. They can usually just kind of OTK you without
No. The way people complained, they needed to have it.
My Trident Dragons.
Wow, yeah. Its price has really fallen. Like the only expensive Trident Dragon is the ulti.
Yeah, so, you know, that's kind of, I'm not surprised to hear just Tenpai in general being a popular one. Like, most people kind of consider it to be like a lower octane deck to pilot. Like, some would say, like, oh, it takes no skill. That would be maybe the less charitable way to put it.
That's what I was waiting for to hear you say.
But like, well, I...
Dodging the issue.
But yeah, that's right. I gotta be diplomatic in this podcast. We're appealing to all players here. No, but I mean, like, Tenpai, it gets you, like, easier wins. And I'm not gonna lie, man, at the end of the day, you're into these tournaments to win, so like if you can get an easier win by playing, you know, a certain strategy, I don't think that is like objectively bad.
Given how difficult I find competitive modern Yu-Gi-Oh is now, I definitely see the appeal of just playing Tenpai.
Break the board and just try to kill him.
Like you're not getting easy wins per se. You're getting wins that will require less mental.
Yeah, less out of you. And, like, the deck has, like, more depth than I think people probably see on the surface. Like, I'm not saying there's, like, loads.
I mean, there's no depth if you're bad at the game.
Yeah. I think the main thing is just that the floor of it is higher. So, even if you aren't amazing, Tenpai can get you. Yeah, you can play Tenpai if you think you suck.
I play Ancient Gear, which is Tenpai with flavor.
Discount Tenpai. Although, cooler Tenpai. Because low-key, like, Tenpai are
Ancient
the most.
Gear Golem is better.
I mean, like, it's true. Like, I think, like, Ancient Gear is actually a cooler concept. Like, Tenpai is just more fiery dragons. Ooh, like,
so original. Like, giant ancient machine thing.
Yeah, so those are the top 10 most popular decks. In other small TCG news, we got this reveal for the promo card for the, like, Supreme Darkness premiere events. It's Argo Star's Glorious Adra, which we already know what the, like, Argo Star archetype is. We've seen that before. I didn't pay a lot of attention to it myself.
I did not either.
But all this really revealed for us is just that they are spelling out Argo Stars without like a star symbol like it has in the...
Now I think about it, isn't there one card in the TCG that has the star symbol?
Yeah, Evil Twins cards. Some of them do.
Evil. Like, oh, I forgot about that. I was thinking about the other one.
Oh.
There's an... A weird elemental hero-like card, like E-Hero something.
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I mean, I know some have, like, accent symbols. There's that one dark one. It's like an evil hero or an elemental hero.
It's a dark one?
It's dark attribute.
Like an accent? Like a...
I think.
Like, what, Eskiri Dao? No, he doesn't have an
accent.
Yeah,
Eskiri Dao, I thought
he does have an accent.
Does he?
I have no idea.
Let's look it up.
I know its name. I cannot see how it's spelled.
It might just
head.
Be that I'm thinking, like, literally of Eskiri Dao, and that's what.
Elemental Hero Eskiri. Because he was an Omni.
Okay,
right?
He doesn't have an accent. Okay. It's just the word is kind of interesting. Well, either way, the Argo Stars archetype kind of are all about continuous trap cards. And so, like, you get continuous traps and stuff. So my assumption is that there might be some synergy with, like, the Odeon stuff or... But
you
those are
say
trap
that
monsters.
All the regular people in the audience is like, floodgates.
Yeah, also Centurion, too, because they become continuous traps with their effect. Like,
oh, that is an interesting synergy. I'm so annoyed with monsters becoming continuous spells sometimes, or sometimes they're continuous traps. There's still monsters in the spell and trap zone. They're not treated as spell and traps.
Every zone now. Like Yu-Gi-Oh! Just every zone is being put to the full use. Like it's just monsters can be continuous spells. They can be continuous traps. They can be equipped spells. There's so many ways that a monster can exist. They can be pendulums if they're in the...
Just wait until monsters start attacking from the grave and banishment.
You know, something that's always been kind of weird is how, like... You know, like, if you place a pendulum monster... Like, so the left and rightmost spell and trap card zones aren't pendulum zones until pendulum cards are placed in them.
Otherwise it's just spell and trap zones.
What's interesting is that, like, if, say, I used, what's, like, the original Sinful Spoils card that just, like, puts one in the back row? Snake Eyes Subversion.
Oh, Subversion. Card. Okay, yeah.
If I, like, use Subversion on, let's say, like, Supreme King Darkworm, Performer Pal Joker, or whatever, and I put it in the back row, and I put it in one of the pendulum zones, it's still not considered a pendulum card. It's still just a continuous spell. Which, like, makes sense, but it's just, like, it's so funny to think that it can... You know what I mean? Just it's... Things can be so wild.
I do believe... Well, no, maybe it can't. Snake Eyes Flamberg Dragon special summon a pendulum monster from the pendulum zone.
Don't think so. Because I think it has to be a card that is treated as a continuous spell. They're considered spell and traps
now. They're not monsters treated.
Woo! Yeah, it's wild. I know that there's always like somebody who...
But it all changes with Valence.
Yeah, and there's like Valence come up. It's like, there's always somebody in the comments who's like, it's so simple. It's because this, and other. And it's like, yeah, that's great. But like for us normal people, or just when you're trying to explain it to a person who is... kind of just getting in, it's just wild.
To understand these rulings, you have to be more than just like a Yu-Gi-Oh! Fan. You have to be kind of a student of the game, where you actively seek out Pendulum, Snake Eye, Centurion rulings.
Yeah, just all these interactions, because it really comes up. Now, moving over to the Master Duel side of things, I feel bad. We've like stopped covering Duel Links, but apparently they're having like the Kaiba Cup this past week, I think.
I just haven't been playing as much.
Yeah. But either way, in Master Duel news, so they actually released the Evil Twin alternative artworks into the game.
The ones that aren't in the TCG?
Yeah. Which I guess they're probably going to be coming in the TCG. And so this was exciting because like these are their kind of like more, I guess, like sexy designs, right? And everyone's like, okay, they're definitely going to censor these. Well, they did censor them. So we got a look at how they chose to censor them. She basically has just
like a fishnet
top thing on.
I'm with it.
So that's kind of interesting. They also took away the tattoo.
Well, you could argue that's too like sexually charged.
Yeah. I'm not even
our
sure.
Poor virgin eyes.
Yeah, because it's like a lip tattoo, and you're not even sure if it's like a tattoo or just like. It's supposed to imply that, like,
Imply that it's, like, lipstick, right?
Yeah, it's, like, lipstick. So, like, Leela, you know, kissed her on the breast, and that...
Yeah, that's a lot.
And, you know, all the six-year-olds who are playing the game...
7 years old. I don't know what you're seeing.
All these six-year-old Yu-Gi-Oh! Players just wouldn't be able to handle that. Also, here's Leela. They covered up kind of the upper thigh, gave her the same fishnet treatment, so...
Okay, I mean... Look... Konami's going to censor, right? Like, this is more than expected. Or not more than expected. It's actually less than I expected.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, you know, because I do think they're kind of busty. I figured they would, like...
Airbrush, shrink.
You know, like flatten that out.
Yeah, flatten that out. You know...
Poor Dark Magician girl knows.
Yeah, people are also upset because they released them as URs. In Master Duel, and the regular versions of these cards are SRs.
Yeah, but if you want, you know, the curvier versions, then...
Yeah, you pay up.
Yeah, you get the...
Which is so funny.
Get that UR dust together.
I think it really goes to... I saw people who are, like, furious about this thing. They're just milking us. This is so awful. Konami's, like, this corporate greedy. And I'm just like, y'all must be, like, new to gacha games.
Yeah, you're getting milked. Yes, that is...
I'm not saying that it's, like, justified that they're doing it. Just, like, this is, like... This is, like, the lowest bar possible. A gacha game, you know, milking you for some exciting new alt art banner. Or she's in a swimsuit or something. Like,
You can earn them with free currency. So I don't know if you really have, like, too much of a leg to stand on.
Yeah, people get fussy about, like, their UR
dust. You have to pay for these cards. UR dust is hard to come by, but... That's why you save it.
I mean, I also feel like that's like, yeah, like it's what separates you from the other evil twin player. Like, you're willing to give more of your make-believe virtual currency that all you have to do is play to get you're more willing to spend it, and like someone else doesn't have to. Like, it's fine. Like, I don't. But some people are really upset. I'm the only reason I'm upset is because I know they're going to release these censored in the TCG, and then like a lost art a month later.
Yeah,
that's funny to me. Like, because that's exactly how this is going to go. They'll throw these in the next like kind of major reprint set, and then be like, "Oh, look, the new lost art evil twin cards." They also just come on, Konami, Jesus Christ!
I'll never forget when they pulled that with the ninja girl. What was that?
Oh,
Mitsu, the insect ninja. Because I remember I pulled a were they Starlights at the time?
Starlight.
I pulled a Starlight Mitsu. And I'm like, yeah, I got one of my Mitsus is now the highest rarity it can be. And then they came out with the Lost Art versions, which is barely a change. If you look at them, there's not that big of a difference. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, I kind of want to run the Lost Art version, but it's only like
ultra like not, rare. It's not like max rarity, but it's like the original art. So now you're faced with this choice of like what's better. One other quick Master Duel thing. So they actually did add some cool new features in the latest Master Duel update. Like, it's small stuff. There's the ability to do, what is it? You can, like, there's a few new features. You can auto-build a deck now.
Okay.
You have the ability to, like, check what deck your opponent was playing, like, in replays.
These are also like Duel Links features.
Quality of Life Duel Links features. They added a few more cards that you can craft for playing in duel rooms and that sort of thing. You can check your deck now while you play, which you couldn't previously do. Like, to see how many copies of something you have, like, left in your deck, you know?
Oh, okay. I thought maybe, like, I was like, oh, you shouldn't be able to look at your deck whenever you want. But I guess...
Yeah, you can in Master Duel. Some people... I saw an interesting tweet where somebody was like, they disagreed with this feature. Because it's not something that you can, like, legally do in a TCG, like...
But setting. There's a lot of things you can do in Master Duel that you can't do in a TCG.
Exactly,
That's kind of the point.
I thought it was an interesting thing, because it was like, yeah, Master Duel is... It's a digital game, and so with a digital game, I think, just come certain expectations of, like, quality of life features.
Mm-hmm.
Like, some people got really upset about the, like, the imperm column thing that they added to Master Duel.
Having it marked.
Some people kind of don't care for that. Or some people, I mean, I saw a person who was even kind of upset that there's like a dual log because like in the TCG, you aren't allowed to take notes.
I mean, back in the old like YGOPRO days, I remember we used those logs aggressively to keep track of things and no one thought it was a problem back then.
Yeah, so that's a small thing. And I guess you could call it Master Duel news also. They did do the Shadow Duelist Cup, the second one.
Yeah.
The sort of Shadow Duelist tournament.
You competed in there.
I did. Yeah, so I competed in this. You guys might remember that last time that was the tournament where they unveiled Zayn Malik.
Yep.
And he, you know, I guess was just interviewed by Konami. It seems like this time around, whoever the celebrity will be, we don't know who it is yet.
Why don't we?
So the tournament was this past weekend, and you played in it, and then they cut to top 32 for day two. And the top two people from that are going to actually duel on the day of like the reveal of the celebrity, which is on the 23rd, I think, of November.
Why is it so far? I guess scheduling.
It's scheduling, I suppose, because it's like, okay, this is probably that celebrity's like available day, but right. They were able to get most of the tournament weeded out and done. So now when that celebrity is live with Konami and them, it'll just be like, okay, we do the finals. Then we do, like, the interview, and then he maybe duels the winner.
Did they do the whole, like, guess who the Shadow Duelist is thing? Like, a clues?
Yeah, they did. Because
I completely missed all of this. I didn't see any of it.
Yeah, they were doing it. I mean, the last I remember really seeing was when I mentioned how, like, the guy had the guitar, and, like, he kind of did the little guitar solo thing, like, in one of the promotional videos. We talked about it 2 weeks ago. But that's, like, the last thing I remember of it. They might have done, like, one more clue, but it seems like the Zayn Malik one was a lot more... talked about, like there were more clues, people were kind of a little more interested, maybe.
I feel like Konami made more social media posts, maybe I haven't been paying attention.
No, I think they did. I think they did fewer this time.
Mm.
So we don't know who it is yet, we'll find out soon. I played in it, I used Voiceless Voice. I was unfortunately not able to make the second day, I really wanted to. But Voiceless Voice suck, and it's not my fault at all that I lost.
Wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It was all, my opponents all got lucky. And I'm
a
victim.
Every last one of them. You went second in all those games, didn't you?
Yeah, I didn't win a single coin flip. Wow. No, I'm just kidding. It was fun. I played against a nice variety of decks. It wasn't bad. I went, like, I think 6-3. And I was kind of upset because, like, my last round like I was like on the bubble. I could have won. You know, it would have been cool. But I realized something as I was like preparing for this tournament. I'd made a little post on like social media and stuff, and I was like, hey, you know, I'm going to be playing in this tomorrow, and like more people should play in these events because they're free. Like it's like a free tournament, and the prize is like a Switch, and, or not a Switch, a Steam Deck OLED, not a Switch, much better than a Switch. And like it's free, and like you don't have to leave. Like you just like play it from your house. And some people didn't know that it was even going on. They're like, oh, this is my first time hearing about it. But also there were a lot of people who were like really downer about it. Like they were like, you know, well, like I shouldn't enter anyway because like, you know, I'm not going to win anyway, so what's the point? Or like, well, you say it's free, but like I technically like I have to pay a bunch of money for like URs and stuff to be able to like, okay, play the deck I want.
All right.
Yeah, and I was just kind of like, y'all are like, do you want to play Yu-Gi-Oh or not?
No.
Yeah, like, you know, because like these people will call themselves Yu-Gi-Oh players, but then give themselves like every excuse in the book not to just play in the free tournament.
I mean, not everyone likes competition. Not everyone does well in a competitive environment.
So here's my argument about that. These are people who like they, because I get if you like truly do not like tournaments, right? Or mm-hmm. maybe if you can't like travel to a YCS, that's like a thing. But I mean, these are people who like they build decks, they play ladder, and they're always keeping up with like, you know, like I want this card to come into the game so my deck can go up a tier and I can like win more on like on ranked and stuff. And it's like, enter the free tournament. Like, come on. Like, just like stop giving yourself like I'm not trying to, it's just coming across as a rant, but I really want it to be more of like a like motive, like play.
Nah, just, you know, rant.
Well, I do want like people to, because these things are
Paul
like
says, stop complaining and play Yu-Gi-Oh.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that like for something that's like accessible and has decent pricing, and you don't have to really like the barrier to entry is so low.
I mean, there is no barrier. I mean, you just have to sign
up.
Yeah,
it's like have a deck.
You
I guess.
Have to sign up on an external like website. You can't do it in Master Duel, which they should just fix that.
Yeah, it would be good if they just worked like within the game. That'd be cool. But anyways, yeah, so we'll get an update on that, I guess, here in another week or so, whenever we find out who the Shadow Duelist is.
Is Mia.
There's one other thing I was thinking about with that Shadow Duelist thing that I noticed is, so I kind of thought like Konami was, I'm still not sure like if Konami pays the people to do, like pays the celebrity, I would assume so, or if the celebrity is like paying Konami. And the reason why I wasn't sure about that is because on the Shadow Duelist website, they have like a sort of application for like if you're a celebrity who wants to apply, which I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, it just feels, it's like, I think that if there's a, I guess they're using that to help with the scouting process of, like, finding right. a celebrity. But I thought it was kind of interesting that, like, the celebrity has to kind of go to them as opposed to them.
You should sign up.
Going to the, oh, they're not picking
you
me.
Should
Konami
be
hates me.
Duelist.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting. That's all the Yu-Gi-Oh news, though.
But that's not all of our card game news.
Yeah, what do you have? What's going on in the card game
so,
world?
Typically, I come to you guys with a Pokemon theft story from some random place in the world, right?
Yeah.
Well, this one's not so random. Why? Because this one took place in my hometown.
Really?
Yes. So I'm from New Orleans, Louisiana, the greater New Orleans area. And this is an area called West Wego. Which is literally
West Wego.
It's called West Wego. West it's literally Wego. Right next to the town that I grew up in, Marrero.
Mm-hmm.
And so the article reads: West Wego assistant fire chief arrested, accused of stealing Pokemon cards from Target.
How lame!
And you're the assistant fire chief. Now I know you're not the fire chief. You're not head honcho, but
close enough.
You're stealing Pokemon cards.
Okay.
Let's get into it.
Yeah, let's.
So it says the West Wego Fire Department is taking this matter seriously and is cooperating fully with law enforcement and is conducting its own internal review of the matter. So according to the sheriff's office, Chief Taylor stole Pokemon cards by creating fraudulent UPC labels. The barcode scanned at checkout that helped businesses track their inventory.
Oh, wow. Huh, he very even, involved.
He even admitted to creating his own UPC labels and placing them on the cards to make them cheaper. See, a single pack of Pokemon cards at Target is $9.99. Now, I don't know what...
Really? That's how much it costs?
$9.99, yeah.
That,
I mean, it's that post-COVID markup, I think.
Jesus, that's a lot. Anyway.
Anyway, we don't know how much he was getting off. Like, I'm assuming because he done this at least three times. Because they tracked him, and that's how they figured out he was doing it. But they say he got away with, or he attempted to get away with over $300 worth of Pokemon cards. And he has been placed on administrative leave while...
What a fucking...
Oh, wait. I lied. He went to jail.
What a fucking embarrassment. I'm sorry. That's... Man, that's...
Like, I know being, like, the assistant fire chief isn't the most glamorous, the most important job in the world, but...
I mean, but it is, like, you know, in a still, way, though. Like, I mean,
like, you're still a fairly, like, prominent...
Like, it's kind of one of those public servant jobs. Like, you... That... I feel like that comes with a lot of... Like, you're supposed to be, like, a role model.
Like...
And it's, like, a public service thing. Like, you're really... I don't know. I just...
And to go so far in it...
Yeah, that's so involved. Like, I thought it was going to just be, like, okay, he just kind of got caught stealing some. But, like, this is, like, a scheme.
Like, yeah, he actually had a strategy that he'd done on multiple occasions.
Yeah, like, this is... I'm sure it was... I find it hard to believe he was even the only person involved.
It's unlikely. I mean,
he might be the only person, like, that was caught. But
you're probably the only one that was caught.
But that's quite a method, you know?
For someone who's allegedly been working for the fire company for 13 years.
Yeah.
Maybe that means they don't make enough money as firefighters?
I don't know. It just means he can't control his freaking Pokemon gambling addiction. That's all it is. Like, maybe he was buying that new Pokemon pack. The one with, like, the $500 Pikachu. Have you heard about this?
$500 Pikachu?
Or, like,
I do have a story about that too.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I just figured, I don't know, do you have anything else to say about the theft thing?
It is weird, in the article, I'm reading a bunch of names of places that I've been and have went to often. That Target is a Target I've been in many times in my life. That the fire station he worked at is one I'd passed up many, many times.
It almost feels like a little...
It feels slightly surreal because, you know, I'm not home right now, but here I am. I'm doing what I normally do, which is this podcast. I'm talking about Pokemon crime. And look, there's one happening in my hometown.
Closer to home than you think.
So, guys, pay attention. Even where you are right now, there is someone...
Stealing Pokemon cards. Yeah, maybe it's your father or something. I don't know.
But... The thing is, why not steal Pokemon cards when you have Pokemon TCG Surging Sparks cards selling for $500 just days after set release?
So this is the Pikachu I think I've been hearing about.
Yes, yes. Yeah. So Surging Sparks, it's only been out for 3 days as the of the posting of this article. I don't know when the date of this was. Oh, it was released on November 8th, so it's been a few days since then.
Okay.
And it has many new bright and shiny cards, yada, yada, yada. The card in question is the gorgeous special edition or special illustration rare version of the Pikachu EX, sitting at an impressive $488.61 market value, according to TCG Player. So, I don't know if you can see it, Paul, but this is the Pikachu. This is what we're selling or what we're spending $500 on.
Looks good, yeah.
Yeah, it's Pikachu EX. You know, EX are a type of Pokemon card. Yeah. And it has this this Terra Crown. And I forget what you call this Terra typing in
like
the game.
Rainbow Terrastalization, something is like it, that.
Rainbow.
It's been a while since I played Scarlet
and Violet. It's something.
But
once I got to that point in the game, I kind of... stopped playing. But, you know, yeah, it's a cool looking card. Is it $500 cool?
I don't know. I mean, what do you think about this? Like, when, because you were kind of mentioning earlier before you started recording how you almost feel like these cards are just, they're at a point where it's automatic that they're just expensive.
Yeah, so I think the valuation of Pokemon cards is kind of dumb. Not completely, because these are real people setting these prices and then real people purchasing these cards. But Pokemon card values have become kind of this weird self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah.
Where if they make like a special illustration Charizard or a special illustration Pikachu, it just...
Or like maybe a Mewtwo.
Or a Mewtwo, right?
Like those
it just
are the three.
Gets a huge like aftermarket price. And like...
It feels... automatic. Like, yeah, it's just like people,
you just know, like, oh, this is going to be the car. It's super expensive, bro. Like, but why? How come when they do special illustrations of Starmie, they're not worth something?
I mean, I know that these are fan favorites, but I still find it kind of strange that we just, there's like this unspoken agreement, I guess, that all Pokemon people have inadvertently, perhaps even unwillingly agreed to, which is just that, like, if there's a special illustration, golden, rainbow, rare Pikachu or Charizard or whatever, it's just gonna cost a lot. Like, and it's not just a lot. It's gonna be, like, well into the triple digits. That's so...
My assumption is that the rules, the typical rules of supply and demand don't actually apply to Pokemon cards. I think there are so many people who probably consider themselves high-end Pokemon collectors that they demand that these cards be expensive. It's like, if someone pulls this Pikachu, right? Mm-hmm. And they say, well, I want to sell it for 100. 50 people all want to buy it for 100. It's like, okay, well, I'll put it at 200.
And just see.
Then the 50 still want it. It's like, okay, well, how can I get this down to like only one person wanting it? And it was probably like $515. So everyone else bowed out. One guy said, I'll still buy it.
I know it's going to sound like a dumb question, but or like a dumb statement, but like I mean it in earnest. I'm always like really wondering where some of these like prices for these cards come from. Like even in like a Yu-Gi-Oh like way, it's like, okay, Molcharmie, Perulia or whatever. Like, I don't know exactly how much it is now, but I remember that for a time it was like going for like $120-140. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, okay, where did that price come from? Like, I know, and someone's gonna be like, it's supply and demand, duh, economics 101, but like,
well, it's not that simple.
But like, I don't know. Like, I sometimes feel like people just kind of like, it's like pre-order pricing is already like reached these certain points. I'm just like, who's just deciding that it's like, it's just going to be 120. I'm just going to like, because I think it's just price setting. Like someone just sort of says 120 and then maybe if you like say it loud enough or something that it'll just be that way.
I think it's a bit like the beginning of an auction where the auctioneer just starts like, they get a piece and, you know, they start with a set price. They say, hey, will anyone take this piece for $400? And if enough people say yeah, then they go up in price, right?
Yeah. It feels like, go ahead.
And I think that's actually the case with these Pokemon cards where, you know, a new illustration of some, like, you know, some fan favorite Pokemon's coming out. And, you know, you're the first person who pulled it. Now, this, you know, you do get to set the price to some degree. Mm-hmm. Now, no one has to buy it, but if you set the price too low and everyone like scoops it up immediately, then it's like, oh man, I should have priced it higher. Like, so I guess
maybe over time you begin to develop just this, like, mm-hmm. you naturally just set it higher from the start.
Yeah, you just set it higher from the start. So at least you don't feel like you've been robbed. In fact, just this past weekend, I was at my local card shop and I saw someone purchase a very expensive Pokemon card right in front of my face. And I didn't know it was, and almost like touched it as like a joke.
Oh yeah, maybe that wasn't.
So there was a Latias and Latios GX card. Here it is, Paul. This was in front of my face just this past weekend. The guy who was selling was looking up the current value on the card, mm-hmm. and he's like, I got to see if anyone else wants this card. I'm like, oh, I'll buy it. He's like, oh, you don't want to buy this. Oh, okay. And I'm like,
how much did he buy it for? How much was it worth?
$500+.
Okay. That's
just like that Pikachu.
Jesus Christ.
I was like, ain't no way. There's no way.
Yeah, that's wild.
Like, not out of nowhere. Actually, I want to say it was like he was trying to sell it for like $600 or $700. It was amount of money that I was not spending on one card that day. Or ever.
Kind of a good segue then into my next story, which is a quick gaming one. Scalpers are reportedly losing money on PS5 Pro consoles.
I had that one too.
Oh, you had that too? Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, so basically, scalpers looking to capitalize on the recently launched PlayStation 5 Pro console have reportedly been struggling to make a profit off of them. So it launched at $699, and obviously that price has been controversial because it's like the most expensive console to date, I believe, unless there's... I think it's at the record.
Some weird special edition, maybe.
Yeah, and so anyway, the PS5 Pro has also become the target of scalping, though the results are a bit different compared to the vanilla PS5's release 4 years ago. So basically, people have been trying to list this thing for for like more, you know, more than the list price or whatever, but people aren't biting.
I mean, like, that only works selling. If it sells out, right?
Yeah. And it sounds like, I guess, Sony has been doing a good enough job of keeping these things kind of on the shelf.
Or maybe, is that what they're doing? Or maybe a good enough job. Is not actually. Demand's not there. Yeah. I mean, there's still Walmart, Best Buy, Target. They all have MSRP prices for this thing. They still have them.
And like, to be clear, good, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not a, you know, I'm not pro scalper. I think that if you try to like, you know, snatch up a bunch of PS5s and all that, like, and try to scalp them, you deserve, you know, if this happens to you, tough luck.
I mean, I imagine.
Sucks.
Because, you know, the original PS5, it came out damn near peak, like, quarantine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was like the very kind of beginning.
There were a lot of people got into that, into that racket, and there were people who made some like good, you know, change doing it. And the, you know, the PS5, it feels so tantalizing because, you know, all the people who were just flipping PS5s, that money's gone.
Yeah.
When you do that sort of flipping, the money you make gets spent almost immediately because that's kind of the personality that you have when you do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they see the PS5 Pro and it's like, oh, I can make that fast money again.
Yeah, and it's just not there.
And it's slow money. It's, in fact, in this case, I guess it'll be no money.
Yeah, because they might end up having to try to sell it for less than MSRP if they even want to get rid of it at all.
Because, I mean, I know a guy who, you know, he flipped a PS5, and I remember he did it with all the money he had.
Oh,
he did.
Dear.
He only had the, like, five or six, whatever amount he had. That was all he had. And he flipped it for almost double, so he's like, yeah! But if he did that with the Pro...
Yeah, sucks to suck.
He'd be out of luck.
There was one other thing I was going to ask you, actually.
What's that?
The Magic the Gathering thing. Did you get... Well,
oh, yeah. Guys, I've had such a wild few weeks, I forgot. So, if you remember, there is, or this was at this point, a Marvel Magic the Gathering Secret Lair that was released last week.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about this. And I wanted to ask, I know you got it.
Yes. Long story short, I participated in the Secret Lair drop.
Mm-hmm.
I was successful. I did not have to bot. I didn't have multiple computers. I was just on my phone.
So how did it work exactly? I know you and Chris were both getting some magic stuff from this.
So I operated on some like bad information the day before. I was told that the Secret Lair drop was at 9 a.m. And that was going to be a little like awkward, but I was like, okay, cool. I will be prepared at 9 a.m. for this drop.
Right.
So I'm kind of going crazy at 8:59, refreshing my phone screen, and 9 hits, and like the website is just kind of just down. There's no changes, no nothing. And I'm like, well, what's going on? How come no one's talking about this? I find out that it was 9 a.m. Pacific time.
Oh, okay. And so, we're Eastern time.
And we're Eastern over here. So it was actually going to be at noon. And I was like, okay.
So
I can work with that. I can work with noon. Like, did I waste some like time? Sure. But I can do noon.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's now, let's fast forward to 11:59. And I'm on my phone, refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
At least this time, within the last hour, the website actually loaded, and now I'm just waiting to get the option to place the cards in my cart.
Okay.
At 12 o'clock, I'm able to press add to cart, and I'd already pre-logged into the Secret Lair website. So then I'm like, okay, let me check out. It hangs.
Yeah.
Like,
you're just like not loading.
It goes to my cart. I hit go to cart. My cart's empty. And so now I'm kind of like jittery, yeah, like, whoa, what's going on? So I'm refreshing. Eventually my refresh finally goes through. And instead of going to a checkout screen, I'm put into a waiting queue.
Yeah, so this is actually kind of the point in the story, I think, where I was seeing a lot of people, this is just the standard experience, was like, you got the thing into your cart, and then you're just kind of placed in a queue and told, like, a time that you'll be allowed into the site. And
so how it worked was, your item hits your cart.
Yeah.
And once you hit that like confirm button, instead of letting you check out, they put you in a line, a queue to check out. You and however many other people were all there at that same time. So as I explained, I was there pretty much as fast as I possibly could have been. But my estimated wait time was over an hour. It didn't even give me a time. It just said over an hour.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. It told me that it was my spot in line was saved and I just had to wait. So, okay, I'll wait. I want to say 30, 40 minutes in, it said line is paused and it stopped.
Yeah.
It would keep our places in line, but for now they would stop taking. They stopped letting people check out, and don't let the page close. And I didn't really know what to do with that. I think that went on for maybe like an hour or some change, or where it just was paused.
So you eventually got in and got your stuff, right?
Yeah, I did eventually get in and get my cards. I actually got the Storm bundle. That's the X-Men Storm.
Yeah,
and
I heard a lot of just dissent online about this, just this secret layer system. Apparently, I guess you used to be able to, like, get your pre-order in, like, kind of easily. Like, I guess they changed
the system. It used to be more comfortable.
I think it used to be, like, as many people could order them as possible, they were, like, made to order, and now it's not like that? Or is it?
Yeah, it was, the windows were for a limited time, but basically anyone who ordered during this couple day period, or even if it was one day, I don't remember how long those windows were. Anyone who wanted them could get them. That's how it was before, but it was made to order. So once they confirmed your order, it would take weeks and weeks and months to actually ship them out.
Okay.
So the rationale was, well, we want to be able to ship our secret layers out faster, so we're going to do the opposite. Now we're going to have a limited stock available because they're pre-made.
Yeah.
And first come, first serve.
Yeah, first come, first serve. Everybody fights to get them, and then you can kind of get them quickly. But there's also kind of just like a lot of fear and paranoia that you won't get in, and like wasted time, too.
Oh, so much wasted time.
You're gonna kind of sit there.
Approximately 3 hours for that whole thing to resolve for me.
Yeah, it's like when you're refreshing like phones and computers. Yeah, I heard a lot of people were not very pleased.
And I was lucky. There were a lot of people who just did, even though they did everything I did, they didn't get in. They didn't get anything. And the only recourse is to buy the cards for more than double what you paid for during the drop.
Yeah, I just gotta, I guess, you know, relevant to the scalping conversation.
I will say, the one bright side is my cards already came in.
Yeah, so it's like, it's cool because I guess once you go through the ordeal, you will like get your stuff and, you know, you're happy and it's great, but
I do feel bad for everyone who was left out, and I'm mad at Wizards to some extent, because I know a lot of bots were at play during, I mean, pretty much every secret layer drop, but especially this one. And at this point, I expect for companies to be able to like filter out the bots. You're going to do these types of systems, you need to do your due diligence and make sure that it's real people.
I think the old system sounds like it probably worked a little bit better, but like, I don't know. I mean, there's just, it sucks, but at least you got your stuff. So
yeah, I got mine. So I'm happy.
Here's my other little quick story. This one was kind of like crazy. Since we've been talking about, you know, companies and money and theft, Marvel Rivals developer may be involved in $130 million money laundering scheme. Maybe you saw this.
No,
it's new. Okay, yeah, so actually it turns out that they were involved in it. This is like the old headline, but...
Oh, when we say developer, we're talking about Nexon, NetEase, aren't we?
NetEase.
Or NetEase.
NetEase,
yeah.
So after news broke last week about NetEase employees being arrested on suspicion of money laundering and bribery, details have started to crop up in one of the most baffling crime stories in recent gaming history. So the story starts to come together through various reports from different Chinese news outlets, and the tally so far seems to be at least 9 arrests and around $139 million laundered. So, yeah, you know, NetEase made a name for itself in recent years with titles like Once Human and the upcoming Destiny Rising and, of course, Marvel Rivals. But according to Yikai Global and Liphone, these are just the two major news outlets covering this, the marketing departments are at the center of the case. General Marketing Manager Zhang Lang has been implicated in the money laundering scheme, and several subordinates are under investigation for purchasing traffic to boost NetEase products on social media platforms.
Not surprised.
Yeah, so kind of interesting. The article is also named former distribution and marketing director Jin Yuchen as part of the case, which allegedly involves up to 27 companies that remain unnamed thus far. The exact figures for the money laundered by NetEase employees remains disputed, but sources range from 800 million to 2 billion yuan. That's basically $111 million to $278 million. But the widely accepted estimate is around $139 million. So, yeah, what do we think about this?
I mean, maybe y'all surprised, but I'm not.
Why aren't you surprised?
I mean, NetEase has been around in, like, the mobile gaming space for, you know, years. Especially, and, you know, it's not just that company, but a lot of those kind of lower effort mobile game companies, they had extremely aggressive monetization practices. Their marketing was aggressive, and
yeah,
you could tell they were willing to do whatever it took to get people to play these games and click on ads and all.
I think a lot about the whole, like, buying of reviews. Like, yeah. You know, with a lot of these mobile games, like, you go on the Play Store and it's like, how does this game have, like, 10 million downloads and, like 5 million reviews and they're all, like, 5 stars? I'm always just like, okay, come on, like, be honest.
I want to say I've played 3 NetEase games.
Okay.
I believe, so there's a game I played twice, and I don't know why there were 2 of them, but it was called, like, On Myoji. And I played this way, like, many, many years ago, and then it came back as a second On Myoji game. I think those were NetEase. I think NetEase is EVE Online and Naraka Blade Point. I think that's them, too.
Okay.
Interesting. I've dealt with them before, so I'm not at all surprised they're dirty.
I wonder how this, I mean, like, you know, so according to this, the arrests appear to have mostly been contained in the marketing and distribution divisions, so they have not substantially affected the development pace of the games under the NetEase umbrella. It's like, yay, hooray, you know, you get to play your Marvel rivals. But it does make me wonder, like, you know, Marvel licensed out, you know, like, the Marvel kind of franchise to them for the development of this game and other stuff like that. So I wonder, like, how they feel about this.
I mean, Marvel actually should just do better. They kind of dole out those licenses for, like, mobile games almost willy-nilly.
Like candy, yeah.
I mean, I guess they go back, because NetEase has a few Marvel titles under their belt, I believe. And there's another company that they work with a lot for mobile games. I think maybe we should not be outsourcing our properties to the, like, to just kind to of...
kind of just these companies.
Any company.
It makes you certainly wonder then, because, I mean, like, also Destiny, like, the official, like, you know, the game Destiny is getting, like, this mobile game, I guess, by them, Destiny Rising.
Oh, NetEase is doing a
NetEase is doing
game?
Destiny Rising. So it's kind of like, and that's by Bungie, so I guess Bungie, like, licensed Destiny out, like, it's a Destiny mobile game. And it's like, I don't know, maybe they... Like, I guess it's fine. Like, maybe this is all fine. Like, it's just, these were just some people, but these were, like, high up management people as well as subordinates.
I wish I could say I'm surprised. I mean, the draw of, like, doling out your license to NetEase, they're promising you, yeah, we'll get you this giant, like, slice of the, like, Asian market, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you know, China, India, they're promising companies, hey, we'll get you here. So, you know, give us the license.
A leaked internal memo translated by Eurogamer confirms that NetEase has let 9 employees go so far for bribery. So I guess some employees were bribed by upper management or something. Or just other companies. I don't know.
If you're, like, laundering money, and you're probably also, like, bribing people to keep it quiet.
But anyways, you know, I guess it doesn't affect the players will still be happy. You know,
they have a Lord of the Rings game. My God, they just have, they have so many licenses.
So they really are, like, that company, right? Like, yes. A lot of companies are just like, here's a small studio, make us something good, make us something on mobile.
Make us something. I don't know if it's going to be good, just make us something.
I mean, at least the one good thing is, like, people seem to think, like, Marvel Rivals will be pretty good. Although, like, it makes you wonder, because...
Look, I've always been skeptical, because I want to enjoy Marvel Rivals to fill that void that Overwatch left. I've always been skeptical that NetEase is the company behind, like, it.
It makes you
Yeah, I don't believe in their quality. I don't believe in their integrity.
Yeah, that's the main thing I always wonder is, like, I don't doubt that the game will be fun to play. I sometimes wonder with, like, these, like, mobile game companies, how much are they going to milk you?
Oh, and a
you
lot.
You know what I mean? Like, it's like, how much money are they going to want?
The answer is a lot.
Because, I mean, you told me, like, some of these mobile games, like, they come and go. Like, sometimes, like, they show up. If they can't milk a few million in the first, you know, X amount of time, like, the game goes. Obviously, like, Marvel's a big deal, so I don't think that would happen. But, like, I'm sure that there are other seedier companies that have, like, gotten licenses to games. And so, either way, I thought this was kind of an interesting one. This was, like, a huge blow. Like, I feel like just, like, I just didn't expect to hear this. Like, $140 million money laundering thing. It's kind of weird, so.
Hey, to them, it's probably light work. They said, why are you coming after me for, like, chump change?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. Anyway, any other stories?
Let's see. I actually don't have anything.
That's okay. Well, that's a great time then for us to try my new little segment I've got in mind for you. I've got something fun.
Oh, I'm scared, yeah. He has not told me. I do not know what's about to happen.
This will be fun, actually. I thought, like, sometimes we're always covering news, but I wanted to, like, do a little bit of research and present something and just see what you think about it. We can just talk about these things. So this is five obscure licensed, like, officially licensed trading card games from history. And I just want, like, I'm going to just name the property, and I want you to tell me, like, what comes to mind, like, as an official trading card game for this property.
Okay, well, I'll give it a shot.
Okay, so first is the Pac-Man trading card game.
Hey!
So, yeah, when you think of, like, Pac-Man getting a TCG.
Okay, so what I'm envisioning for a Pac-Man card game.
Yeah, it's a card
it's
game.
It's a competitive game. It's you and your opponent, but you're not battling each other. You're trying to capture the ghosts.
Okay.
And your decks are built you're trying to, like, maybe draw into a power pellet. Like, you and your opponent, you're taking turns trying to, like, draw into a power pellet, and once you get a power pellet, it'll let you then, like, claim a ghost, and maybe the first one to get three or maybe five ghosts wins.
Yeah, it's sort of like that, but not really. So
I had to try.
Pac-Man stickers and rub-offs, commonly referred to in shorthand as Pac-Man trading cards, were released in 1982 by the company Fleer.
Oh, so this wasn't a trading card game. It was just...
Well, it kind of is, though.
Oh.
So each pack of cards included three sticker-backed cards. So you got, like, stickers.
Yeah.
You got three coin scratch-off games. So that was the gimmick, was that you...
They were scratch-offs, like cards, the lotto?
Yeah, you scratch off the material with a coin, and it lets you go through, like, the Pac-Man maze and, like, collect, or I guess, like, eat ghosts. And you also got a stick of bubblegum.
This feels like training for, like, to play the lottery.
Sort of. Instead of ordinary trading cards that feature... Instead of ordinary trading cards featuring the classic arcade game's characters, they sold scratch cards that let the buyers reenact a Pac-Man level by scratching their way around the maze. The main sticker cards generally feature Pac-Man and the ghosts with speech bubbles above their heads, with the characters saying phrases like waka 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 and catch me if you can. Also, when they made the Miss Pac-Man expansion, her cards feature some...
A Miss Pac-Man expansion?
Yeah, there were, like, expansions to this. There was, like, a main set and a couple of others. Apparently, there were even some, like, released in other countries that have, like, slightly different printing processes and stuff, so they have, like, different values.
Hmm.
Like, some are sort of seen as more rare. There's, like, a whole site that documented this. Like, it's, like, there's, like, a type A,
sure,
type B,
type
C. Sure,
there's someone insane enough.
Yeah, like, there's, like, type A is, like, worth more. And anyway, the Miss Pac-Man cards feature some notably indecent and sometimes risque quotes, such as Miss Pac-Man saying, "I'm a liberated woman," which I guess that was considered... quite risque at the time.
Yeah, I was saying, I was like, I don't know if that's risque at all.
Yeah, I was thinking, I was like, what is a liberated woman? Well, besides, like, you know, the obvious definition of the word, and it's just, that's what they meant. It's like, she is a woman who just...
I thought you were going to say, it's like, it's Miss Pac-Man, and she's got, like, long legs and, like, fishnets or something.
Yeah, I mean, so, but I guess in 1982, though, right, like, a woman saying that she's liberated was maybe, like, a big deal.
I guess. Because
you weren't supposed to say that... That, you know, like, I can, you know, have sex with whoever I want, or I can, like, marry whoever I want. Or no, that's like what a liberated woman would be. Oh, she's okay. Not saying that she did those things, but the fact that she's saying it at all and, like, bringing it up might give the kids, like, you know, some bad ideas.
I like these Ms. Pac-Man cards. I remember when they were Pac-Man cards, when a man could be a man.
Yeah, so here's a picture of the packs. I found somebody actually selling these on eBay.
And you bought them?
I did not. I thought they'd be fun to buy on the podcast, but I just prepared this like this morning. And then also, here's like how the rub-off game looks. So like you have your cards and you just kind of use your coins. Now here's what's cool. They actually have instructions for how to play the rub-off game.
Just like if you buy a lottery ticket.
Yeah. So how to play. You start at the yellow Pac-Man and you rub off gold dots one at a time. You can go in any direction, backward, forward, or sideways, as long as you follow the maze. You may not jump over gold dots, but you can go over dots you've already rubbed off to get to other areas. You can go outside doors to get to the other side. If you uncover three colored monsters, the game is over. Now here's the cool part. More than one person can play by alternating turns or using their own Pac-Man boards. And you can use Pac-Man stickers as prizes for trading or for collecting. And they even have a little spot here for your name and your score. So
this feels like such a like 1980s like product.
Doesn't it? Here's some stickers. Like this one, he says, "Happiness is a hungry Pac-Man." Or this sticker that says, "Slide out the side door." Or "I'm cooking now." Or "I'm cooking now," is like one of the ghosts is saying. So, yeah, I mean, like, you, what do you think? Would you play this? Does this kind of feel like a little time capsule?
No, because, like, it just feels like lotto training. And you know how I feel about the lottery. To be clear, I don't like it.
I mean, I guess the difference here, though, is that, like, there's not really, like, you're not scratching off to get anything. Like, you're just doing it for your entertainment.
Oh, it's about, you know, but it's getting you into that.
But it's the process of the scratchy.
Get the feel.
The scratchies.
Right, you read your instructions, you learn how to scratch, and you might win a prize.
How much do you think these are go for today?
Today?
Like, it's like a pack of these.
Well, how much
like
they go pack. For back in the day?
I think back in the day, I wasn't able to find out exactly how much they were, but I think it was something along the lines of, like,
probably some
49 cents or, like, 99 cents, maybe.
I mean, it depends on, like, what the collector's market for such a product is. Mm-hmm. I imagine, like, an unscratched Pac-Man card.
Well, it's like an unopened pack.
Like, unopened pack,
so remember,
because
you're getting your bubble gum and your stickers.
Yeah, sure. It has to go for, like, a few hundred, I'm sure. Maybe, like, $200-$300 for an unopened pack.
Yeah, I was surprised to find out they're actually quite cheap. They're, like, $6.99.
Oh.
Like, $5-$6.
I just figured, like, collectors would have, like, made them disappear already.
Yeah, so I thought that was kind of cool. I think it's neat that they give you, like, bubble gum, like, it's a little stick of gum. Like,
I feel
like
gum is still good.
Probably not, right? It is from 1982.
Oh, you need to pick some up so we can find out.
I might, actually.
We'll chew the gum on screen.
Yeah, like, break our jaws.
And we'll find out which one of us is the better Pac-Man player.
Yeah, so it just has, like, a cool, old-school, arcade-feeling vibe. And I think that giving you a stick of gum is, like, probably for the kids. Like, so the kids will...
Yeah, maybe.
You can buy your kid, like, a...
Well, I think the kids were the ones who also played the game. I don't know if there were many adults who were like, yeah, this is what I'm... This is my, what I'm about. Pac-Man.
Okay, now here's the next game.
Oh, there's more?
Yeah, I've got a few. SimCity the card game.
Like, you know, the Sims.
Game? No, SimCity. Like, you know the game SimCity? Where you, like, build a city and, like, kind of govern it and stuff.
Oh, the PC game.
Yeah, the PC
Sim
game,
City.
SimCity.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry, I was stuck on The Sims.
So when you think of SimCity, like, what comes to mind? Like, a SimCity card game. Like, what? How would this be
okay,
played?
Okay, let me think. If I'm doing, like, a SimCity... So what I'm imagining is... It's not a, like, a collectible card game, like a competitive TCG, but maybe more like a, oh, this is, like, more
like
a board game. Like, cause, like, it's hard to imagine, like, yeah, I really can't figure out how you would turn a city building game into a card game. That feels too difficult.
So here's what's interesting. Here's, like, a picture of, I guess, kind of a pack. SimCity, the card game. The goal of the game is to build a city from the ground up. So kind of like what you'd expect from SimCity. Now, here's the thing, actually. It feels more like a card game today than the Pac-Man game does. Players take turns playing cards representing city blocks, and they collect profit. The original game was released in 1995 by Mayfair Games and contained 517 cards. Sold in 60 card starter decks.
Oh, okay.
And 15 card booster packs.
Oh, this was a TCG.
Yeah, this is like a TCG. There were 363 standard size cards and 154 long cards, which I'll get into that in a moment.
Yeah, so it's a long card.
Yeah, so a standard size card would maybe be the size of like a Pokemon card. A long card was like, I guess, well, I have a picture later. It's like maybe twice as long as like a regular card. The object of the game is to build a municipality through four phases. The settlement phase, the town phase, the city phase, and the metropolis.
Okay.
So you're going kind of from like a little village to a full, you know, metropolitan area. Each card has a value and a zone associated with it. The latter indicated by the color on the title box. The seven zones are agricultural, city services, commercial, government, industrial, residential, and special. So, yeah, here's a few of the cards. If you wanted to have a look, like for instance, there is the like the detective agency or the embassy, or also like a retail game store. And so they have like this money symbol, which I think is, I guess, like their profit. And then this other symbol that I'm not entirely like sure exactly what that is. I guess like that's maybe the zone that it's. Yeah.
I'm really not sure how to feel about this.
And now here's one of the like long cards.
The World Trade Center.
Yeah, the World Trade Center.
They don't look like that today.
Yeah, they don't. this was in 1995. I guess the World Trade Center was like still.
It was different. TSA wasn't a thing.
So, yeah, now here's what's interesting, actually, is that at the time, its critical reception was noted as one of the, quote, lowest conflict collectible card games at the time, since the aim of each player is to just add to their own city. And the only attack cards were natural disasters.
Oh my God! You used natural disasters.
Yeah, so I guess if you use a natural disaster, it could like blow down someone's city.
Or
like
activate Hurricane Katrina.
Yeah, exactly. You can destroy the place.
I'm flooding your streets. Your levees are now broken.
Mm-hmm. Knock their town and their city down.
I counter with FEMA.
Wow. Jesus Christ, yeah. So I thought that was kind of cool. A little Sim City trading card game. Would you play this?
No.
Why not?
Because my idea of a card game is shaped by almost exclusively by Yu-Gi-Oh. There's nothing Yu-Gi-Oh about that.
I suppose that's true.
Except for attacking with natural disasters. Giant Trunade.
And this did come out before Yu-Gi-Oh did. Although I think Magic came out before that. All right, now the next one gets a little bit like risque.
Okay.
This is the last one. So these are the most wanted Iraq playing cards. So
I've actually heard of these.
Yeah. So you tell me.
Well, I can't say a lot about them.
Or just like what have
you
heard?
But I've seen that essentially this was like a trading card game, but the cards were, I guess, essentially criminals.
Yeah, during the 2003 invasion of Iraq by a United States-led coalition, the U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency developed a set of playing cards to help troops identify the most wanted members of President Saddam Hussein's government, mostly high-ranking members of the Iraqi regional branch of the Arab Socialist Ba'ath Party, or members of the Revolutionary Command Council. Among them were some of Hussein's family members. The cards were officially named the Personality Identification Playing Cards, and as of 2024, all but four of the 52 most wanted have either died or been captured, 11 of whom have been released.
Yeah, that's a dark game.
That's dark, isn't it?
That's a dark game.
That's creepy.
That is. It's hard to even imagine, like, your country's at war, and so the country that's against you, they created playing cards with your face and like your loved ones' faces because they want to capture and or kill you. You know, that's not a very fun game, I don't think.
And you know, like,
did the soldiers play with them? Was there like attack points?
So they were actually like made to just be a deck of playing cards. So it's like, you know, ace of spades and all that
stuff. A 52 card deck.
Yeah, so it says like each card contains the wanted person's address and address, golly.
Oh my and God, that's
so is it getting doxxed by the game, Lord?
Well, I mean, this isn't doxing, because I mean, the goal here is like assassination and imprisonment.
And if available, the job performed by that individual. The highest ranking cards, starting with the aces and kings, were used for people at the top of the most wanted list. The ace of spades is Saddam Hussein. The ace of clubs and hearts are his sons. And the Ace of Diamonds are his presidential secretary. So
that's some dark shit. So wait, so was the list exactly 52, or was it like a little bit larger and they had to cut some names out? Like,
ah. It was 52. That's what they say. It was 52.
I feel like the list was either was longer or shorter, and they just made it fit 52. I would feel bad for anyone who got added to the list because the list was actually 49, and they're like, oh, we're so close. Yeah, let's just add somebody.
Find extremely distant family members. Let's add Saddam's
cat.
Yeah, his cat's a card. I thought that was kind of creepy because it's like, I mean, I guess that these weren't like distributed in stores or anything. Like, it's not like they're like selling, you know, the War on Terror cards at your local Walmart. Imagine
they probably showed up at Pawn Stars at one point and like, probably got bought by some like war memorabilia collector.
Yeah, so I've also got two more. That was going to be my last one, but there are two more that I wanted to bring up. So
we don't end on a such a...
Yeah, I didn't want to end on like such a dark note. the first one is the XFL cards. Have you ever heard of the XFL?
I wish I hadn't.
Oh, okay. So when you think of these, what comes up?
Football.
Yeah, in 2001... WWE owner Vince McMahon tried to expand his brand of sports entertainment to football. This is the genesis of the Extreme Football League, which was his response to just the National Football League. Thinking the XFL would one day eclipse the NFL, the company made tons of merchandise, including Topps trading cards. So here's the thing. These actually aren't special at all. They're like different than regular football cards, except that they have like slightly edgier kind of graphic designs.
I would say they're special in that the XFL is long gone at this point, and... Apparently, I imagine there are XFL collectors out there.
Apparently, the XFL tried and failed to return in 2018. Yep. But when it did, it released a new set of Topps cards as well.
Oh, huh. Well, they were really dedicated.
Yeah, because they filed for bankruptcy like as soon as this thing came out.
Yeah, but the XFL was short-lived. I think The Rock was trying to get involved with it.
Interesting.
I don't know whatever happened with that.
Huh. Yeah, so would you like... collect some XFL cards?
No, I didn't even watch the XFL.
Would you even collect NFL cards? I guess we don't.
Really, I don't collect any sports cards. Not interested. Not my thing. I collect Yu-Gi-Oh cards.
All right. Well, here's the final game. I want you to take a guess at what it is.
Matt, I mean, you've done cards from all over the place now, but I'm assuming it will be different from all the others.
Really? What a bold guess.
Well, because the thing is, before this game really started, I was thinking you were going to reference older, more anime games and stuff. The Naruto card game. But you really dug for some really deep history.
All right. Well, this game is called Bible Battles. Bible battles let players recreate biblical conflicts.
That's dark because a lot of biblical conflicts have some really dark implications.
Given its religious importance and significance around the world, the Bible being a massive pop culture force might be odd to some. But the Bible inspired everything from movies to edutainment, and trading cards are no exception. In the Bible battles trading card game, players role-played biblical commanders and waged holy war. The set features more than 500 named cards for six ancient nations, including Babylon and Rome. Meanwhile, people like King David can be used during play. So,
I want to say there was like an old cartoon. Was it Moral Oral where they had like biblical trading cards? It was some old cartoon that did that.
Apparently, it actually plays kind of similar to like Magic the Gathering.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Like, I was trying to find... I'm going to try to find a picture
of it. It actually has an anti-partner mechanic. So, if you have Abel set as your commander, if you play Cain, he dies.
Wow.
I don't know if that was
I saw there was, like, a King David card that, like, when it enters the arena, it does, like, some certain thing. So, I was like, okay, interesting. This is a little bit crazy. Here's the two starter decks. Mm-hmm. There's the 60 card Israelite starter deck.
Okay.
And the 60 card Roman starter deck. So.
Woo! That is something else.
Yeah, and here's what it says in the back of the box. Ever wonder what it would be like to have King David defend Jerusalem from a horde of Babylonian chariots? How about having Emperor Augustus lead massive Roman armies in an assault against the Assyrian forces of Assur? Assur, yeah. Well, Bible Battles TCG brings the Old Testament to life with 500 unique cards from six of the ancient nations. This original and exciting game offers great family fun and provides a unique educational tool to help children and adults alike learn about the amazing people and relive the stories from thousands of years ago. So, here's a card back as well, Revival Battles, if you were.
I mean, I guess it's a good, a decent enough tool to learn some like actual history. Mm-hmm. I imagine Bible Battles is not around today.
It's, you know what this reminds me of? Do you remember a few years ago, we were like, they announced like the Jesus video game or something?
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I don't remember what that was called, where I was like, you play as Jesus.
And you can kind of just do anything.
And you kind of just do whatever, but like also you're going to get like, I guess, crucified. And then...
it's inescapable.
But then like you move the rock ends. A few days later and like you come back to life. You
gotta rise up. Yeah. What happens after? No one really knows.
Did that ever come out?
I mean, I'm sure.
I don't really know, but. Yeah, so those are my games. Did you enjoy a little bit of history today?
I learned some things, that's for sure. I didn't love it all, I'll tell you that. I didn't love it all, but.
I mean, I thought this would be kind of just fun.
I think the biggest surprise still for me is SimCity actually being an actual trading card game with like one that you compete with you someone compete. Over. I did not see that coming. You could have given me 1,000 guesses.
But I love the natural disasters thing. I think that's hilarious. I would
never have seen that coming. Someone plays like an earthquake card or
for the listeners out there, I want to know which of these five games. I mean, I guess XFL is like not even really a game to collect. Like, which one would you collect and play? You
want to play which one?
Bible Battles or a set of War on Terror cards?
I would not want.
I think that I'll just stick with. I was gonna say I think I'll just like stick with SimCity. If I'm being completely honest. Now here's the game that we're gonna play. We're gonna give each other one IP. It can be anything, and you have to imagine how that would become a card game. Like, how would you make a card game out of it?
Okay.
If they can make something out of SimCity, then I figure...
then nothing's off the
table. Nothing's off the table. So, you just, take a moment to think of just like some IP that maybe would be like kind of difficult to translate into a card game. Because, I mean, these days we have like Star Wars has gotten its TCG and stuff. And that came out whenever this year. So, like, what are you... You can give me one or I can...
Okay, I got one. Ooh, Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood.
Oh, man. Okay, that's interesting. I feel like this would definitely be a game that's aimed at kids.
I mean, it's
like a kids show. I don't remember that much about... like, I watched a lot of Mr. Rogers, but I feel like...
all right, I'm going to switch it over to Sesame Street. Everyone knows Sesame Street. Everyone does.
A, I'd be surprised if Sesame Street did not already have some form of a card game. But yeah, 100%. Like, you can make the characters Elmo and the,
Ernie. I mean, that's the easy part. But what do you do in the game?
So I think that it would probably be like... because Sesame Street was like based in like a neighborhood sort of.
Yeah, it was on the street of Sesame Street.
So I'm guessing, this feels like, I think board game, but like it can't really be a board game per se. Maybe you are like, you have like something like locales that you play as cards and then like there's kind of just like your characters maybe like.
Like Big Bird's house or Nest Big Bird's, and Bert and Ernie's apartment.
Yeah, and like the one guy who lives in the trash can.
What was his name? Oscar.
Yeah, Oscar. Like, so like locations are kind of like field spells maybe in Yu-Gi-Oh. And I guess like since it's supposed to be like a game for kids to learn, you attack your opponent with like life lessons or like trivia. Like they have to kind of like answer something, and if they like answer it right, then they deal damage to you.
I play the count. What's 4 + 3? If you get it wrong, I get a gold star.
Yeah, I mean, Okay, well, here's mine. I've got to give you one. What TV channel did you watch the most as a kid? I'll pick from that. Like, if you had to say.
If I had to guess, like, Cartoon Network, I guess?
Cartoon Network, okay.
Safe pick.
You have to make a Powerpuff Girls trading card game.
That's too easy.
Is it?
I mean, yeah, you could make a very standard TCG where, the Powerpuff, each Powerpuff Girl is like a character or a card, but also any of their allies are cards too. The Professor can be kind of like a trainer card, some type of support card. The villains are cards too. You could make it, it could be a competitive game, you versus a person, but it could even be one of those kind of deck builder style games where like each person maybe takes the role of a Powerpuff Girl and each girl has a play style in their deck and you are cooperatively fighting a different bad guy every session. Maybe it's Mojo Jojo, maybe it's him, you know, Fuzzy Lumpkins.
What would Chemical the Rowdy X Rough be?
Boys. Who?
What would Chemical X do? Like would that be like an equipment chemical, type of thing? Artifact?
I feel like Chemical X would be a powerful card, maybe like a one of in your deck that lets you just kind of like combo off for like a turn.
Combo off.
Yeah, like it will be a resource, like a really good resource.
Okay.
That lets you maybe play more cards in a turn, do more attacks, deal more damage. Yeah, at least there'll be other support cards that could be in your deck, right? The Mayor, Ms. Bellum.
When did they finally show her face?
No, what? Of course you can't not. Do that.
Yeah.
You see her face, the game has to end.
That's true. There's like a secret rare, like, Ms. Bellum's face card. It's like one of one. No one's seen it.
Turns out, just it's the mayor's face.
Yeah, exactly the mayor the whole time. Cool, I thought that'd be fun. I don't know. This is an experiment. I was like, I'm just looking at some card games. We can do pot now. Hopefully you guys enjoyed the... What?
You do this almost every week, but this time it caught me off
guard. Yeah, we can do our pot now. All right, we got viewer questions.
Time to draw two.
Next week I'll come with some new weird trivia factoid thing. We'll see how it goes. I'm sure I can think of something fun. But yeah, as always, if you guys want to submit questions to the Pot of Greed, you can follow the link down below the podcast. We would appreciate hearing anything you have to send us. Maybe Yu-Gi-Oh! Related or otherwise.
All right. So I have two right here.
Okie doke.
First question. What is the best way
to... You have to take a moment to read it because like, it's just kind of
here we right go. On the card. What is the best way to intro new people into the game that actually works? So the best way is tough. Because, like, I don't know how we define, like, new person.
Yeah. Are we're talking Yu-Gi-Oh, of course.
Like, have they never played Yu-Gi-Oh before? Are they a returning player? Like, have they played a card game before? I think the answer to those questions will change your approach a bit.
Yeah, so I have a bit of a... This is, like, a hot take or anything, but just sort of an approach. Is that, like, I actually prefer to just let people watch it first. Don't actually try to, like... start from anywhere explaining to them, just like sort of sit them down and be like, hey, okay, I'm gonna play against someone else, or maybe I'll like play some Master Duel or whatever, and just be like, and you can just sort of like watch, because I feel like that kind of helps them to see how it looks in action and if it's something that they would even really want to play, first of all.
Mm-hmm.
And then you know, now as far as like the teaching part, I mean, I feel like that kind of gives them something of a baseline to work from, maybe.
I mean, I think I would go for, because I feel like a lot of people, when there's a newer person entering the scene and actually get into Yu-Gi-Oh, typically it's because they saw a monster or a card that they thought was really cool, and like, I want to use whatever this is. I don't know how to play this game, but I want to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the first thing I do is identify what do they like.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you're in a bit of a spot if someone sees a copy of like Diabellstar and they're like, "Ooh, I like this. How do I play this?" It's like, "Oh man, you really want you like that?" Okay. It's like if someone,
so you kind of broach their interest with like the theming or the pictures.
Yeah. So it's like, for instance, if somebody wanted to play Diabellstar, I probably would not start with the basics of Yu-Gi-Oh. I would probably try to teach them how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! Through a Snake Eye Diabellstar deck versus starting them off with like a starter deck where you're giving them a chance to lose their interest. Like, how does this get me to the thing I'm actually interested in? I want to know, how do I use that?
Yeah, it's true, because like whenever starter decks exist, like we, you know, the two-player starter deck came out, it's not great. things like that. I mean, I feel like they're so far removed from how the actual Yu-Gi-Oh! They'd be playing anyway, mm-hmm. that I don't find them very helpful. So you're right. I mean, it might just be better to give them an archetype that they like thematically, like just, oh, I like the picture on this. And then, yeah, just kind of explain Yu-Gi-Oh! Through that lens, like the lens of that particular archetype.
I think maybe after you get them hooked with this, learning how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! Through an archetype, you can go back and teach them the basics once they're already in.
Yeah. But
when someone's not in, I find it hard to just teach them caveman Yu-Gi-Oh! On up.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you are trying to start from the very bottom of
which
it.
Which is for the best, to be clear.
Then I would say just grab a speed duel box. I mean, I think like Speed Duel, even, you know, say what you will or may about its appeal to like an established player. I know some people don't really care for it, just don't find it interesting. But I mean, I do think it does a good job of teaching. The turns are pretty simple, and because the hand size and the field is kind of more condensed, I feel like it's less daunting.
Right.
Like, you know, your turn's going to be a pretty basic move. Your opponent's turn is going to be a pretty basic move. Someone will win within the first few turns, and then you can just sort of continue from there. I mean, like, maybe the skill cards part might be seen as a little bit, because like it's not really reflected in the final game. But skill cards are usually straightforward enough that it's not so bad.
I mean, if they're fans of the anime, I think speed duel boxes are really useful. You know, if they're a new player and they only watch the anime, another good option is the retro pack. If you can actually draft out retro pack like we do in Retro Rivals and mm-hmm. teach them how to play Yu-Gi-Oh! With cards that are familiar to them. That I think if they're playing with their giant soldiers of stones and their dark magicians and they're learning how to tribute someone, yeah, learning about damage calculation.
Familiar.
Because at the end of the day, you just don't want it to be a dry experience where you're just showing them the base mechanics of Yu-Gi-Oh! With cards they don't care about. That's my only issue with like the 2-player starter deck. It will teach someone how to play the basics of Yu-Gi-Oh!, but it's with a bunch of monsters that, like, arguably no one cares about.
All right, well, my question is, can you explain Master Rule, like, what the Master Rules are? Like, what is Master Rule for? I started playing Yu-Gi-Oh! Before, or after, I guess after that was a thing. So this is not, like, this is sort of an explanation. I guess I can just quickly say, Master Rules in Yu-Gi-Oh! Are basically these times in the game throughout like its 25 plus years where the kind of some fundamental rule of how the TCG is played gets introduced or changed. So usually it's just introducing a new summoning type,
mm-hmm.
Synchro or Xyz. So like Master Rule 4 specifically introduced Link monsters and the extra monster zone and all the rules that came along with that. But Master Rule 3 was like the introduction of Pendulums, and Master Rule 2 was, you know, like Synchros or whatever. And the first Master Rule, like, revision, I think, was maybe something before that. But, yeah, so that's really, like, all they are. And, like, right now we're in what's called Master Rule 4 Revision. Yep. So, basically, they took the rules introduced in Master Rule 4 and kind of undid them somewhat. The whole thing where, like, you can only special summon Synchros or Xyz or whatever to zones that a Link monster points to. And now you can summon them anywhere you want.
And if you want an example that's based on the American legal system, imagine the Yu-Gi-Oh! Rule set is like the Constitution of the United States. There's a lot of things in there, most of it you don't know. The Master Rules are kind of like adding new parts to the preamble. You know, the Bill of Rights, the most important part of the Constitution.
It's like amendments.
Like, imagine like just changing, you know, the right to free speech and the right to bear arms. Like,
yeah.
Every so often, you get to change one of those. Just spice it up a little bit, you know?
I mean, I guess to complete the analogy, there are a lot of people who view the Second Amendment as the most important one, and some would say that, like, Master Rule 2 was the best Yu-Gi-Oh! Because that was, like, Synchro era, and some people think that was, like...
See?
Others think that's when it was ruined. So who knows, right? But yeah, that should pretty much answer the question. Master Rule 4 Revision is what we are currently in, and right now there's sort of some talk about, like, should there be a new Master Rule, given that Yu-Gi-Oh! Already has a lot of different summoning types. And like the rules kind of feel like enough as it is, but some people want a new Master Rule. So cool.
All right. My second question. It says, oh, speaking of rules, what rules would you add or change
or remove?
Or remove. Okay. So what rules would you add, change, or remove I'm assuming this is about Yu-Gi-Oh. Okay.
Yeah, Yu-Gi-Oh rules. Okay.
It's hard to
pick like one of each, maybe or something like that.
Yeah, that's gonna be interesting. Okay. Add, change, remove. I never think about Yu-Gi-Oh in terms of its rule set, so this is a bit interesting.
I guess this person's probably like referring kind of more to mechanics in the game or something. Like that's what I kind of assume. Like for me, for instance, the mechanic I would want to remove would probably just be like missing timing. I find it's kind of one of those mechanics that I don't like it because it's hard to explain to new people because the way that it's like the cards are like written, it's like if versus then, and like it just feels like it goes against the common sense English readings of how of like effects.
Right.
Like, you know, when this card is destroyed, you can do this thing. And it's like, oh, my monster was destroyed, why can't I do it? And it's like, because it says when, not if. And it's like, you know, I find that that's like kind of just a little sloppy. I think that if they could just patch that out of Yu-Gi-Oh. Just
move or miss timing. You know what I would change? I would change I forgot what I was going to change. I did forget what I was going
to
change.
It was like something to do with like a summoning type or chains or monsters.
Oh, I got it. So I would change that detaching Xyz materials are not sent from field to grave.
Oh, so you think they should be considered like sent from
field to grave? I would send them from field to grave because it never made a lot of sense to me when I was learning about Xyz monsters. And even today, I mean, these are cards on my board still. You're telling me they're not on my field, even though I'm looking at them on my field. I would want them to say, I would want that rule change to just say, oh, when they're detached, they are still leaving the field and going to the grave.
Yeah, no, actually adding a rule to Yu-Gi-Oh, I'm not really sure. I mean, I guess the popular answer among maybe some more casual crowds might be like a summon limit or something. Although I genuinely don't think a summon limit's the answer to Yu-Gi-Oh's woes.
I think the one I want to add is very small and like I don't think it really helps anything.
What do you want to add?
I want to add a rule that says that depending on which scale you use, you can only use the scale on that side of a pendulum monster.
Oh, interesting. Oh, so you wanted pendulums to have more depth, is what I'm really
because like I never made. Why were there two? Like,
yeah,
they should have just had one pendulum scale on them if the slot didn't matter.
I guess it was just for the aesthetic.
It's a waste of space.
I do think that that pendulums were very underutilized in that way. Like, I thought it was going to be like, okay, like your right side had to be this way and your left side had to, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, why else have two numbers?
And so it would like matter because like if the red side's 4 and the right side's 6, then it matters now which zone you place it in. Perhaps they found that too complex.
But we've never had a pendulum monster that has different numbers on the sides. And given the way that they work, it would be confusing now. But I would like to add a rule where
it that matters
the side corresponds to or the scale of your monster is dependent upon which side of the pendulum scale it's on. Yeah. Make it more complicated just so it makes sense.
All right, I'm gonna like add a slightly petty one myself just because like this tends to be like exploited a lot. I think that if a card and like I don't know, I'm just kind of thinking off the top of my head. If a card is negated, like its effects are negated, then you shouldn't be able to even attempt to like activate its effects. So where that came up for me like recently was like I use an Imperm on an Izolde.
Yep.
And like the Izolde still just was like, okay, I'm still just going to like send these four equip spells.
Because you can activate and pay the cost.
Just because I can activate and pay the cost. And like I get it. That's not, you know, like I know mechanically why you still... Like, whenever I say stuff like this, there's always someone in the comments who's like, no, like, it still works because I fucking know how it works, dumbass. Like, I'm just saying, like, I think it's kind of annoying because it tends to just get abused. Like, and the reason why is because costs in Yu-Gi-Oh! Today are, like, really built to be beneficial.
Costs are effects.
Yeah, they're part of the effect. Like, so many cards these days, like, Konami designed their cost to be something that puts them in a beneficial place or sends something.
A cost
something,
that
you know.
Sends a grave. That's, you know, we have a card with an effect to send the grave. Foolish Burial.
Yeah, it's like, oh no, my, you know, Mathmech Circular made me send a Mathmech monster from my deck to the grave to activate it. Oh my gosh. Magician Souls made me send like a spellcaster and set up this combo. What a high cost to pay. And it's just like, yeah.
Cards might as well say, to activate this card, draw a card.
Yeah, so like when I just, so my example like came from Izolde specifically, where it's, you know, Like, she's negated. Like, you shouldn't be able to, you know. That's petty, maybe. Okay, my final question is, I play Yu-Gi-Oh! With my brother, and we play pure decks with no extra engines or hand traps. We find that this is better for letting both people get a turn. Your thoughts?
I mean, I think it's a fun way to play. I've played like that before.
I'll say this. Well, sorry, no, you had...
Oh, I was just saying that it works when, like, you have a very small group of people.
Yeah.
And it's very controlled. Because Yu-Gi-Oh! Is difficult because everyone's goals aren't the same. Mm-hmm. Yes, we all want to win, but how we go about it is different. In order to dedicate yourself to playing pure decks with no extra engines and hand traps, you know, that means your goal is not just to win, but you want to have, like, a specific experience.
Yeah, I was going to add that it does take, yes, having a group that kind of agrees on how these decks are meant to be built.
Easier said than done.
Yeah, it's easier said than done. It sounds like this person has their brother, so it's probably a little easier. But also, I think it is important to mention you do still have to, like, be... Like, the typical aging power creep thing with Yu-Gi-Oh! Still takes effect. So, yeah. Like, a deck built pure, even, from, like, you know, 2024, 2023... will just be naturally a lot stronger than, like, one from, like, 2018 or something. So you still kind of have to...
I built my Altergeist deck, and I built my Tenpai deck.
Yeah, like, it still, you know, might not really be great. And then the final thing that I've just found in our own experience is it's sometimes fun to add a few hand traps or, like, staples. And, you know, like, you have to just wrestle with what your definition of, like,
a staple is. Draw the line wherever you want.
Like, it's like, for our duels, we kind of will use, like, Imperm in our decks.
Yeah, we'll use Ash Blossom. Like, Ash, Imperm. We'll use Imperm.
But we won't use, like, Shifter, Droll, Nibiru. Like,
we have played Triple Tactics Talent.
Yeah, which I find, like, isn't so bad when the decks are lower power level.
Are we going to add Thrust now that we have Thrust?
Yeah, that's true. And now that I can have, like, a bunch of Thrust, just throw them in my decks. I mean, I don't even think that, like, Triple Tactics Thrust is... super overpowered when it's used in, like, weaker decks. And if you're staying true to that, like, pure thing, then it could actually be, like...
you're only ever searching, like, an engine.
Yeah, an engine thing. So maybe it's not so bad. Anyway, cool. Those are the questions.
Which brings this episode of The Pod of Greed to a close.
Unless you're a channel member, you get a little bonus episode right after. But
that's right.
For the rest of you guys... thank you so much for joining us this week. It's been a load of fun. Let me know what you thought about my little TCG trivia game thing.
It was darker than I expected.
Yeah. I'm interested in what people are going to play. Are you going to play the Bible battles? maybe. Cool. Anyways, thanks so much, you guys. We appreciate your support as always. If you want to become a channel member and support the podcast, feel free to with the join button below. If you want to leave questions for the Pot of Greed, feel free to do so at the link below.
And we will see you guys in the next one.
Pass turn.